If you listen to Monster Talk, chances are you enjoy a good fright. But is that all there is to monster legends and ghost stories? On Monster Talk, we like to look at what science has to say about such things, and tonight, we begin a two-part look at the scientific investigation of the paranormal. In this, part one, we'll discuss two ghostly legends and some of the best practices of historical ghost investigations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Welcome to another episode of Monster Talk, the podcast equivalent of turning the light on in the closet. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzno, we talk about monsters. Tonight, we begin a two-part discussion of how to do historical paranormal investigation. We'll be using ghost cases, and this episode gives two different ghost stories with different conclusions, but you'll note there are many similarities as well. Pay attention to Karen and Ben's stories, and you'll hear these common elements. How to pick a case to investigate, identifying what phenomena is being reported, finding witnesses or written testimony, checking to see if stories match the facts, finding corroborative evidence, and finding falsifying evidence. In part two, we'll go into more detail, and I'll discuss my investigation into the ghosts of the SS Watertown, and we'll discuss Ben Radford's upcoming book on scientific paranormal investigation. Stay tuned.
Monster Talk.
Okay, so this is actually, this should be our best audio quality ever. Until 2 weeks from now when I get my new mic.
And our least interesting show.
Sadly enough, the content won't match the quality, but that's okay.
We'll make it short then.
I was only joking. Come on, we're all ghost hunters now, aren't we?
Yes, of course.
This is our thing.
Yeah. So tonight we're going to talk about, I always say tonight, like everybody sits down for a nice evening by the fire to listen to Monster Talk. I don't know what they're doing.
That sounds nice, though.
It does.
That's the way it should be listened to, I think.
Is sip some whiskey and listen to us.
On an old radio machine, which is how our audio quality is usually set up.
Through a Frank's box.
Through a Frank's box.
A little cat curled up at the corner.
That's the filter I've been using.
With a dunce cap.
Tinfoil dunce cap.
Well, that's quite a picture.
It should be our new logo. We can have Daniel draw us that. That'd be great.
Crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, where were we? So I wanted to talk about ghost investigations, but also specifically, I think we're going to have a few shows on ghost investigations or monster investigations. And I wanted to talk about, start out with historical investigations, because that's the kind I'm most able to do.
Me too.
It's because, doing active investigations with a lot of field work is time consuming, and you have to have the free time and the ability to coordinate with the witnesses or the people who are having the experiences. But a lot of skeptics who might be able to do some of these historical investigations may not realize that this whole opportunity is out there for them to find a case that they're interested in and look into it. So I thought maybe if we talked a bit about some of the ones we've worked on, we could talk about how to do such an investigation and some of the cases we've done.
I think they're good ones for armchair skeptics, aren't they?
They are, because, you don't have to be in an armchair. You could be in a library chair. That's true.
Yeah.
I think we lost Ben.
No, I'm listening. I'm waiting for something intelligible to respond to.
he's crafting a foil dunce cap.
See you, Ben. But I think all investigations to some extent have to involve historical research. I think that's a sort of fundamental prior step.
Yeah, and I think that's probably true to some extent for both the skeptical investigators and the non-skeptical investigators. I get the impression sometimes that when people well, I shouldn't make allegations, but it seems like some of the so-called psychics may have been doing some very rudimentary investigations from a historical perspective before they walk on scene.
That's a hot reading.
It sure is.
Yeah, I that you come across that a lot, where you know there will be investigation by some so-called ghost hunter group or paranormal investigators, and they'll trot in some friend of theirs who claims that they communicate with ghosts, and you know, as you said, sometimes they've already done previous research on it, or other times they may live locally. You know, they don't necessarily bring in psychic mediums from across the country. It may be someone who's regional, and in that case, it's very likely that they may have grown up, you know, hearing stories about who was supposed to live there or some of the phenomena there.
That reminds me of that Bridie Murphy case, just by picking up these things by osmosis, living somewhere and just hearing the stories from people in the town.
Exactly, the reincarnation case.
Well, I was going to say, for those who don't know the Bridie Murphy case, that's probably one of the most famous previous lives case, right?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah. Not to be confused with, who's it, Audie Murphy?
Yeah, the gay cowboy from the 30s.
No, it was the most decorated war hero from World War II.
Oh, yeah, well, my bad.
Right.
Easily confused.
You're thinking of Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, okay. Wow. Well, why don't we start out by each of us has, you know, some good investigations under our belt. Why don't each of us sort of pick one of our historical ghost investigations and sort of give a little intro on that?
Yeah, actually, Karen, I was just looking at yours on the Waverly Asylum.
Sanatorium.
Sanatorium, right, exactly, in real life, right?
But that's interesting that you should say asylum. I mean, it's a bit of an asylum of ghost hunters nowadays. But for a period, it was a home for the elderly. Some call it a geriatrics hospital. I think it was called Woodhaven. And that was a period of maybe about, 10 years or 20 years. But before that, it was a sanatorium for people suffering tuberculosis.
And where is that?
It's in Louisville, Kentucky. I've been criticized. The article that I wrote is on bad language at the moment, just on the homepage. I've left it up there because I did an interview recently and had to speak about this. So I wanted people to be able to go back and look at what I've written. And I had a number of believers who were sort of set upon me and criticized me because, not for the article itself, but just for the introduction where I talk about how difficult it is to find the premises themselves. And so this is going back some years ago, maybe about 5 years ago, that I did this investigation. And it was at a time where it wasn't, the directions were not advertised online. So it was hard to find where this place was. It was more word of mouth, and it had been on shows like Taps. So really the owners were trying to keep it under wraps because they had so many incidents of people who were trespassing and breaking into the premises. So it's just off the Dixie Highway anyway, near a place called Bobby Nichols Golf Course. And anyway, so it was a sanatorium for people with tuberculosis. And the biggest claim is that there were 63,000 deaths which took place there. So there were almost 50 years of operation, but as I said, for part of that time, it was a hospital for elderly people, and for the rest of the time it was a sanatorium. So that's quite a claim, 63,000 deaths. I went there, I did one of their tours. They've got overnight ghost tours, they've got history tours. So I did one of the history/ghost tours, and they've got a so-called historian on the premises, and he was repeating that claim as fact. And he also stated that between 1 to 3 people died every hour, so that they were having a minimum of about 24 deaths per day.
So the Black Plague or something.
It is sounding like that. And
World
I mean,
War II.
There are a number of movies and books about this particular place. And if you really follow what they say, then the place is just a building of horrors, and that there's a place that – an area that they used, they call it the body chute, but it was actually used for laundry and just for carrying things on the premises in general. But people claimed that so many people died there that they were moving them through this chute, this body chute, and it was a full-time job in and of itself, and they're just moving these corpses down this shaft. So I was in contact with a historian, and his name escapes me, a true historian, who had a relative who died there. And so he's wanting to put together some facts about Waverly Hills. And so he really takes umbrage at the claim that there were 63,000 deaths. And see, there's another factor involved. There was a fire, of course, in which a lot of the records of the hospital were destroyed. So it is difficult to calculate how many deaths took place. But this fellow read an autobiography by one of the doctors who had been on site there. And the figure that he arrives at is a great deal lower. It's about 7,500 people who apparently died there over the 50 years of operation. So that's a great deal smaller than 63,000. Dr. Frank Stewart, in his autobiography, states instead that I think there were a maximum of about 150 deaths per annum. That was the highest figure anyway, and that was with the return of World War II victims. So you can see that figure, 7,500, and it could potentially be a little bit higher or a little bit lower. That is just an estimate, but based on the autobiography of this doctor who worked there for, I think, about a decade, and claims that the highest figure was 152 people who died in 1 year, and that was really taking into consideration people coming back from World War II, where you can imagine under those circumstances they would have been picking up all sorts of illnesses and bringing them back into the country. So that would have been a worst-case scenario.
It would be surprising if there weren't more during that time. It would be surprising if there weren't more. You didn't see a higher per annum during that time anyway.
Exactly. So potentially we could be looking at a lot fewer deaths than that, if that's the highest figure. But there are many other claims of the place as well, that there were lots of cruel and brutal treatments which took place, and some of those were supposedly administered to people when it was a hospital for the elderly. People claim that electroconvulsive therapy was very common there, but I don't see that would necessarily have been the case if it was a hospital for elderly people. Then having ECT is not really, it's not like it was a psychiatric hospital of any kind.
Right.
And certainly in those days too, they, for a number of years up until the 40s, they didn't have antibiotics which were useful for tuberculosis. And so they had a number of treatments which by today's standards would be considered to be very painful and just very basic. And so they weren't of much use. I think they used to, and I've mentioned some of them in the article, but I think they used to try and inflate the lungs or to also puncture the lungs and deflate them so that they could take out lesions. So some of these treatments were pretty rough going and didn't work. So people were in continued pain, and most conditions were, when they would get to that extent, would be terminal. So I guess they were really scraping the bottom of the barrel for their treatments and doing whatever it was that they could as a last-ditch attempt for some people who were clearly dying of tuberculosis. So there were also claims that one of the rooms was a slaughterhouse.
Because don't all hospitals have a slaughterhouse on the premises?
Exactly, yeah. So you can just butcher animals for the kitchen there.
There you go.
But this room was alternatively used as an autopsy room. So not only, I guess they talk about multitasking, not only would they perform autopsies on patients who died, but they would then bring in a sheep and kill it for dinner.
What about ghosts? I mean, so when did the ghost stories start?
The ghost stories. There are plenty of ghosts. There are shadow people, and there's the ghost of little Timmy who moves balls. So,
little Timmy's balls. Tell us about little Timmy's balls.
He has red balls, big red balls. And
did you see these? Basically, you just took this on someone's word.
I saw the balls.
You saw
little Timmy's balls. Are you getting this, Blake?
This is being recorded.
Awesome.
So people bring along their own balls for Timmy.
So people bring their balls. So Timmy, like when you go visit, Timmy will play with your balls.
Did you bring your balls, Karen?
I didn't have any, but there were balls there, so I availed myself of those.
So you play with someone else's balls.
That's right.
Okay, great.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, there were red balls everywhere, and people bring them in because Timmy apparently moves them. So it's not a breeze, it's not the wind or anything like that. It's Timmy. It's his ghost.
Now, when you say balls,
Inflatable balls.
Right. Okay.
Medicine like balls, whatever balls you've got hanging around, I guess. Usually the kind, I guess, you get in a target or something like that. So just bouncy balls.
Yeah.
And were there
a little kid can play with.
Were there like videotaped images of this where you could actually see the balls moving independently on their own, or what was the quality of evidence for these?
Well, I think TAPS had some footage, but that doesn't mean anything at all. Other than that, it's all anecdotal. So it's what people claim that they see, and just about everyone who goes there is a believer. I mean, they're wanting to turn the place into a haunted hotel. So it's another one of these most haunted places in America, like everywhere else. And so they're really wanting to find the capital so that they can turn this place into a hotel, and they're leveraging the stories there. So there's also an apparition of a female who's shackled and covered in incisions and screams, "Help me." So I think that stems from the whole idea of there being an abattoir or a slaughterhouse there as well.
Hmm.
And probably the most famous story would be that of the nurse of room 502. So here's a bit of intrigue. So I'll read this from the article. I've got it in front of me. The most common version of this story tells of an unmarried nurse who had an affair with a married doctor in 1935 or 1926 or 1930. So she became pregnant, and her grisly solution was to abort herself and flush the fetus down a commode. That's a quote. In her shame, she hanged herself from the rafters of room 502. Wearing a long white nurse's gown covered in blood, she now haunts this room along with a ghostly companion.
You know, just if she was going to kill herself anyway, why bother with the abortion?
That's a really good point.
It seems
like
kind of...
if you're going to inject logic into this, this is going to be a very short conversation.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
So other than that, there's another nurse who contracted tuberculosis. She jumped to her death from this fifth floor room as well. And there's a fellow called Ralph who haunts the halls of the third floor. However, there aren't any records. I know I've just said that a lot of these records were damaged, but there are no historical records that claim that these people exist at all. So they just seem to be anecdotes.
Yeah, they sound like urban legends.
Yeah, I think when it comes to stories of hospitals and sanatoriums, you've always got haunted. They're always haunted by nurses and doctors, aren't they?
Yeah, well, you know, and just to clarify that, it's the lack of specificity that I'm saying why I think it sounds like an urban legend. It's not just because it's a ghost story, but because it's kind of vague. The dates move around. People don't agree on the general details. Those are kind of like the hallmarks of
indeed. They're very nonspecific, or if they are specific, they're conflicting.
What struck me when Karen was talking about the story was she was describing the doctor in the white, and it reminded me of Lady Macbeth, you know, and the whole gothic idea of a wailing woman dressed in white, covered in blood, the story of La Llorona here in New Mexico, of the woman who drowned her children and then was lamenting and wailing and whatnot. So that,
that's the river woman, right?
Yeah. It fits in, you know, perfectly with you know, the urban legend and the motif. So
yeah, it does sound like a traditional story.
So what was the reaction? You said that you'd gotten some flack or some static or whatever you call it in Australia from some of the believers. But did the people who contact you, did they dispute your analysis, or did they just sort of nitpick at a couple things and bitch?
Oh, look,
that?
I don't think that they read beyond the first paragraph. They were really, I guess, trying to chip away at my research by treating just the first few lines where I say it was a difficult place to find. But as I said, this was written 5 years ago. So the information was just very Spartan then. Nowadays, it's really turned into a big tourist industry for this particular place. And so they're really, it's just a non-issue for them to treat.
Well, really, Karen, you should, you know, seriously, I mean, I don't mean to, you know, criticize a fellow investigator, but you should have known that 5 years later it was going to be easy to find. I mean, come on.
Well, I guess, you know,
obviously it invalidates your entire investigation.
Well, that's the way that they perceive it, yes. So I guess I need to just go in there and edit that section out because
then
the rest of it
that.
Is factual.
Well, so how did you pick this case to investigate?
Well, I happened to be in St. Louis, Missouri for a conference, and it was only 200 miles away. This was a real flavor of the month with TAPS and all of the various ghost hunting TV shows at the time. And it was just too close I mean, I'm living in California, and so it's a great distance from there. But being in St. Louis, it was close enough. I just had to make the trip for the weekend to go and check it out. A lot of interesting doings at the place. Before it was sold to the current couple, Tina and Charles Mattingly, it was going to be turned into a big, or they were going to place a large Jesus Christ statue on the building. I think Christ the Redeemer Foundation was interested, and they purchased the estate and wanted to build a statue like the one in Rio de Janeiro, which is a strange thing. And I think they didn't get the funding for that, and they didn't get the support from the local council. So they lost out money, and the place just really fell prey to trespassers and vandals. And I think it's from that that the haunted reputation arose.
For Waverly, were you one of the first? It was my understanding that you were one of the first, if not the first, real skeptical investigator to do anything there. Was that, had there been other people who'd done stuff before you, or were you pretty much the first in?
This fellow's got an excellent website where he's really trying to compile historical research about Waverly Hills. Mm-hmm. And so, as I said, for personal reasons, he has a personal investment in that. And so I would say, I would call him the first skeptic, even though he may not call himself a skeptic, the first person to undertake critical thinking when it comes to a lot of the claims.
So looking back at the methodologies that you use for investigating historical cases, I wanted to talk about some of those. We talked about how you picked this case. You picked this case because it was already prominent at the time, and yes, you had the opportunity to be in that area, which is, you know, yes, this opportunity attack, right? So mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, and I think, you know, you need to have some sort of interest in the case in order to really do a good investigation, because these are not easy. This is a lot of work.
I guess I'm interested in alternative medicine and just medicine in general. So this appealed to me as a case for a lot of the treatments that people did undergo there. I was interested in that too.
So I think one of the things we have to do as investigators is write down what phenomena are being reported, and then who were the witnesses, or were there any witnesses, mm-hmm. and then kind of figure out what evidence there is to support the claims. And mm-hmm. so in this particular case, you heard lots of stories, but aside from some TAPS video, did you see any evidence that anything was really going on?
I think the evidence basically involves EVP, so the collection of electronic voice phenomena. And this would, by and large, be collected from people who have attended the ghost tours. So they're going there specifically looking for evidence. And other than that, it's primarily anecdotal. I spoke with staff there. I spoke with their historian. I did a lot of research online. I checked out books as well, and statistics in general that I could find. And that was the best evidence that I could come up with. I mean, we're talking EVPs and just a couple of photographs of the ball having moved. That's about it. So nothing captured red-handed. And the quality of the EVPs, I've got some of them on here on in my article, and their messages, like, one of them is, "Oh my Lord," and another one is, "Got to get out of here, Bo." So they're quite meaningless. Other than that, also some blurry images of orbs but anecdotal evidence.
Nothing like Timmy saying, "Quit playing with my balls," or that's what I would expect.
No, nothing that good. They've also had, with that six-hour Halloween haunting episode that was shown on television, they had viewers who would phone in and also claim that they'd seen things. So you'd have people just calling in and saying, "Oh, I saw a floating face in the background." And so that was all counted as evidence.
So the EVPs, did they sound like they were noise, or did they sound like maybe it was picking up other people talking, or...?
You have so many people that are going through there, and I think that they would account for a lot of these shadow people too, that we're just dealing with other groups of people being given the tour. You've got concurrent tours. So I think from the EVPs that I've heard, they seem to be background noise, humans. Really, we're not talking cross-modulations or anything that complex. It's just people being in the background, and you've got people running around screaming. You're bound to just pick up background noise. Gary Busey.
Oh, there you go. Did you happen to notice how many rooms were there? Like how many beds they would have been able to house at one time?
I do have some more statistics online. I think they could hold up to about 400 people. Initially, when it opened, they had about 50. They could hold up to 50 patients. And so in the end,
I see right here. It's the city built to treat up to 400 patients.
Yes, and it's so, there's a photograph underneath too. The premises are absolutely enormous. It looks like an old, expensive public school or something.
Yeah, it does. It looks very gothic, kind of. So that would have effectively caused the entire population of the hospital to be wiped out 157 times to get that 63,000 people.
Yeah, it just sounds very unrealistic.
It really does. I don't think I'd want to go to the hospital if that was the death rate.
Exactly.
It's like, holy crap, just leave me out in the street.
So it's a very impressive figure, but I was immediately skeptical when I heard about that.
Did you challenge the anybody there, or you just sort of let it be?
I did challenge the historian a number of times, but he was woeful and couldn't really talk beyond a couple of stock phrases and things he was parroting. So I don't think he was a historian so much as a tour guide.
Monster Talk.
Ben, tell me about the chemo ghost case that you did.
The chemo ghost. Well, yeah, that was the case that I did. Actually, it was published in the May-June issue, May-June 2009 issue of Skeptical Inquirer. It was a local case. When I grew up here in Albuquerque in New Mexico, I had always heard of the chemo theater and its supposed ghosts as I was growing up. The chemo theater, it's an Art Deco style old time theater. It was built in 1926 and it's in downtown Albuquerque. It's still used today for everything from burlesque shows to movies to plays and whatnot. But it had always been, it's a very distinctive looking theater, again, partly because it's this sort of, basically the story always went that there was a young boy haunting the theater. And again, I had never really given it much thought one way or the other. And then, I lived in Buffalo for 10 years, working for Skeptical Inquirer. And then when I moved back about 3 years ago, I decided it was high time to, do some ghost investigating in my backyard. And so I went and, started looking into the haunted chemo theater, which is actually one of the most, supposedly one of the most haunted theaters in the American Southwest. It's just sort of, I guess, if you look at other reputedly haunted places, certainly Texas, Arizona, Colorado, it's one of the top ones, particularly if you're talking about theaters. The story goes that even today, when people put on plays and do performances at the chemo, they will leave donuts for a ghost. This seemed a little odd to me. Bakery goods for ghosts was a little odd, but it turned out that the story goes that if you didn't give this sort of sacrifice for this ghost, little Bobby, the boy who's supposed to haunt the theater, would ruin the play, would go out of his way to make sure everything went wrong. So allegedly, to this very day, anytime anybody, the cast and crew goes in there, they actually have a shrine in the back of the theater. It's a small little space, about half the size of a closet, with all sorts of trinkets. There's no donuts there now. They removed them for health reasons. But there's all sorts of other things, ranging from theater slippers and photographs and trinkets and little toys and red balls, as far as I know.
Wait a minute. Like they were concerned the ghost was going to get high cholesterol?
Well, I think it was more a matter of the health inspector didn't want the ants and roaches and other miscellaneous nasties coming to.
Gotcha.
I mean, I think the idea was that if the ghost isn't going to eat these things, and apparently he wasn't, that more mundane creatures would.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. Did he actually eat them like Santa Claus or something?
Well, apparently not. Although the story, depending on which story you look at, apparently there are reports, and by reports I mean a guy wrote something on a blog one time, that at one point when donuts were left out for Bobby, there would be small child-size bite marks on the donut. Now, what is a child-sized bite mark look like, and couldn't an adult's nibble look exactly like a child's bite mark? I mean, come on. But that was a story.
I'm sure a dentist could check some dental records or something.
Yeah, do some forensic odontology. Absolutely. But what was going on was that every Halloween, the local media would trot out this ghost story. Invariably, one of the local TV stations and or one of the, you know, either the Albuquerque Journal or one of the alternative newspapers every single year would have, and as we all know, the chemo is haunted by little Bobby, blah, blah, blah. And so it was this recurring thing. And yet, other than a couple local ghost hunting groups, and I'll talk more about them later, nobody had really done any investigation into it. So the story goes that, and this is sort of where it got interesting, was that there actually was a, you know, as with many cases, there actually was a death there. And what had happened was that there was a young boy named Bobby Darnell, and he was killed in a an explosion on August 2nd, 1951. There was a boiler explosion in the lobby of the theater. And Bobby and a couple of his friends and some of the theatergoers were there. They were there to see an Abbott and Costello film. A siren in one of the films scared little Bobby, and he ran into the lobby just at the wrong time. And that was when a water boiler exploded into the lobby, killing little Bobby Darnell and injuring several other people. You know, this certainly really happened. You can find it in the August 1952 Albuquerque Journal. And so there's pictures of Darnell and all that. But the story goes that years later, there was a supernaturally ruined performance at the chemo theater that was attributed to little Bobby. And that's sort of where the story behind the leaving the donuts came from. What happened was that there was a performance of A Christmas Carol. What happened was that the story is repeated by Dennis Potter, the current technical director who was there at the time, tells the story again in multiple iterations on TV and in newspapers and on websites. He talks about how this group came there and they were doing a performance of A Christmas Carol. The director of the play saw these donuts that had been left up for Bobby, and he said, "Well, what are these donuts doing here? This is ridiculous. We're doing a play here, you know, set in a depression. You've got donuts in the back of my set. Take them down." And of course, everyone said, "No, don't take the donuts down!" Right. So this big production is the typical, you know, "No, you'll scare the ghost." And the guy's like, "I don't believe in ghosts. Just take the damn donuts down." So sure enough, they took the donuts down very reluctantly, and that led, allegedly, to what certainly was claimed to be one of the highest profile poltergeist cases in history. Allegedly, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. There were actors who forgot their lines. Actors tripped over each other. Parts of the scenery flew up in the air unbidden. The lights exploded. Just basically anything that could go wrong did go wrong in front of, you know, hundreds of people in the audience and certainly the entire cast and crew.
Were all of these actors aware that the donuts had been taken away?
Well, see, there's an interesting question. Yes, apparently so, because again, you have to remember that everyone was making a big deal about how the director, a guy named Andrew Shea, was not supposed to take the donuts down. So the cast and crew were apparently nervous about, you know, invoking little Bobby's wrath, little 6-year-old boy, for that. And so this of course intrigued me, because if true, and let me emphasize, if true, then again, this would be one of the highest profile documented poltergeist cases in history. Hundreds of people seeing presumably paranormal activity. You know, I was, of course, skeptical about it, but I wanted to look into it. And at first I thought that it was just an urban legend. My first inclination was that somebody had just, you know, made up something or whatever else, and that there was really no truth behind it. But in fact, I found out that there in fact was a performance of A Christmas Carol. And there was some question about when it occurred. Some people said it was in the 70s. Some people said it was in the 50s. And some people thought it was in the 80s. And so that's sort of where I came into the case, was after doing some historical research on it, I realized that the version that appeared in most of the accounts could not be true, because that was set in 1974. And the reason that couldn't be true was because in 1974, the Chemo Theater did not have on Christmas Day 1974, the Chemo Theater did not have a production of A Christmas Carol. In fact, it was a porn theater. And they were actually showing a film called Teenage Fantasies. The subtitle was, "If Throat Made You Tingle, This Will Make You Twitch."
But the Donut Ghost people glazed over that.
They did glaze over that, yes, just like a glazed donut. It was curious. So
it was a very traumatic experience for little Bobby.
Well, yeah, exactly.
This is the worst Christmas Carol ever.
This sucks, man. What are these people doing? So that was my concern, was that, you know, I figured if little Bobby was in fact disturbed by something, it was probably the bad 70s porn instead of the lack of donut.
They're always little, aren't they? Little Timmy and little Bobby.
Yes. Yes, poor little Timmy, little Jimmy, little Bobby. So essentially, that was the first step, was establishing the particulars. When did this happen? This massive ruin, supernaturally ruined play, and establishing the date was, of course, the first step. I quickly realized that the most common version of the story could not be true because, again, it was a porn theater in 74. I went and contacted Dennis Potter, who again was the technical director at the Chemo Theater and is still there to this day. And he was there that night. And he said, no. He said it wasn't in 74. It happened much later, in the 80s. Although he, oddly enough, didn't remember the date or even the year. I found that kind of odd. I think that if I had witnessed a supernaturally ruined performance, I might remember roughly what year it was, but in any event, his memory was a bit fuzzy. Yeah, but again, he was one of the main sources of the story, and so as I dug more and more into it, I kept looking for other eyewitnesses. I mean, if this happened, and again, you have to understand, this ruined performance of the Christmas Carol is the crux of the case. That is the case zero, essentially. That's where all this stems from, was the night that the donuts were taken down and Bobby had his revenge. Everything really hinges on this. And so presumably there would be dozens or hundreds of witnesses to this, and I was eager to talk to them. And I began, of course, with Dennis Potter, who again was there that night. I expected him to sort of say, well, no, we all made it up. And he said, no, he said, I was there that night and that's what happened. So that sort of put an interesting turn on it, because I had a first person eyewitness account of poltergeist activity who was, you know, he was there that night. I mean, that's where he works. That's what he does. And he swore up and down. He said, I know for a fact this happened. I saw it. He said, you know, I saw the actors tripping on things. I saw pieces of scenery flying across the stage. I saw the lights exploding. I saw these things.
So it wasn't recorded at all?
Well, no, it wasn't recorded, which in and of itself isn't necessarily a given Christmas play in a theater. And right. I mean, of course, that would have been excellent, but unfortunately it wasn't. So I interviewed Mr. Potter at length, got all his information, and then I said, okay, well, let me talk to other people. And so I tracked down several other people who were involved in the play. I tracked down the director of the play, Andrew Shea, who's now in Texas. And I also talked to, among other people, the man that played Bob Cratchit in the play. A guy named Steve Schwartz, I tracked him down and I said, what can you tell me about this, the night that Bobby ruined your play? And he said, well, it went great. It was a wonderful performance.
Wow.
That's a direct quote. I said, okay, I may have misinformed here, but I understand that, you know, everything went wrong. He says, no, I don't know what Dennis is talking about. I was there that night. I was in the play. Nothing bad happened. It went fine.
Yet all the people in the audience reported having seen three ghosts.
Spookily enough. And so, okay. And so I recorded the conversation. I took notes and everything. And so then I tracked down Andrew Shea, who directed the play. And I, because, you know, it's possible we've got two different people remember things differently. It's entirely possible that, in fact, the play, you know, weird things happened and, you know, the actor in the play just didn't remember it. I mean, so I needed to have at least a third source, if not more. So for a third opinion of what happened that night, I contacted the director, Andrew Shea, And he said the same thing. He said, quote, there were no events during my 8 years there that didn't have mundane explanations. I don't remember anything supernatural or out of the ordinary happening. He says, I don't remember it being a disaster in any way.
So things might have happened over the course of time, but everything had a natural explanation.
Yeah, well, I mean, he said that over 8 years, he said, you know, nothing. He said, yeah, I mean, people would lose their keys or, you know, and of course, you also have to remember, as both of you do, but our listeners might not, that theater folks are very superstitious. You know,
oh yeah.
One of the first places that you're going to find ghosts is in theaters. They everything from not saying the names of certain Shakespeare plays to you know, knocking on wood,
breaking legs.
Exactly, breaking legs, this and that. So theaters are inherently prone to superstition anyway, and when you layer on top of that the actual historical fact of, you know, there was a 6 year old boy named Bobby who did die in an explosion at that theater. That's certainly true. And so you sort of see how this came about. And what was fascinating to me was that in many ways, you know, I tracked the story down to Dennis Potter, to one man. Mm-hmm. There are many places on the web and in magazines and books where you'll see references to the Chemo Ghost. And there are one or two people who, you know, say they saw something here or there, but the vast, vast majority of the story all comes down to Dennis Potter. It's just about everything comes from something he said or quoted him or wherever else. And so what was interesting was, you know, in my doing all these investigations, it's very rare for me to be able to track down, you know, where did this come from? This came from Dennis Potter. That's where the story came from, is to be able to nail it down so specifically. And I, in addition to Andrew Shea and Mr. Schwartz, I talked to a couple other people and who were involved in it. And again, nobody else remembered that. And I also went back and did archive research in the Albuquerque Journal, and I looked up the reviews in the Journal, in the Albuquerque Tribune. And the reviews said it was a great show. You would think that... You would think that if, you know, a performance was so bizarrely and supernaturally ruined by a ghost or anything else, somebody might have mentioned it in the reviews the following day, but that wasn't the case.
That's a good example of looking at parallel sources to find pieces of evidence that kind of answer the question. The idea of looking at the reviews, that's not necessarily an obvious thing to go check. So good job.
Yeah. I mean, again, it was, well, thanks. I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, I wanted to insulate myself from the accusation that I'd only, well, you know, you only talked to one or two of the other people. Well, first of all, this play actually happened. I think we narrowed it down to 90. I'm forgetting that off the top of my head. It's like, it was actually like 86 or 87. It was fairly recently. I wanted to sort of have an objective third person, you know, account of this, who was there that night. And in a way, I mean, I was kind of, I was happy that I had sort of gotten that far with it. I was slightly disappointed that I didn't get a chance to talk to dozens of people who could provide me with eyewitness accounts of paranormal activity. I mean, I was kind of looking forward to that, but that didn't seem to be the case with the Chemo Ghost.
So I guess the big question is why? What were his motives for starting this story or for spreading the stories?
Well, that's of course, you know, the crux of it. You know, after talking to the director and the guy that played Bob Cratchit and other people, I went back to Dennis Potter and I said, Mr. Potter, I don't mean to cast aspersions on your recollection here. But apparently you're the only person that remembers this. And he kind of looked at me and said, well, you know, I know what I saw, and which is, of course, the common refrain that we all hear. Well, I know what I saw.
Yes. Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, what do I do with that? And so, you know, there are a couple ways you can look at it. As an investigator, my preference is to not cast aspersions on people's motives. You know, there are plenty of liars and hoaxers out there, but there are many more who simply just misunderstood or misremembered something. Mm-hmm. And unless I have hard evidence that somebody is flat out hoaxing, I tend to attribute it to you know, ordinary misremembering and things like that. And so in the case of Dennis Potter, who, again, remember, you know, every Halloween he's on TV. Every Halloween he's being quoted in the paper because he's the guy that's telling the story of the chemo ghost. I think there's a couple things to it. The first one is that the chemo theater was getting some publicity from their resident ghost. I mean, I don't think that was the main thing. I think in many ways a lot of the people there were really found it more of a nuisance than anything else. But it's certainly true that there was some incentive for Dennis to continue the story. But the other thing that was interesting to me was talking to him. And again, when I confronted him with the contradictory reports, he just sort of shrugged and said, well, you know, I don't know why they're saying that. It was really interesting to me, you know, coming from a background in psychology, to see just how convinced he was that his recollection. I mean, he looked me in the eye, he swore to me, he said, I saw this happen. And my answer is, I believe you, but it didn't happen. I mean, the overwhelming evidence is that what you're telling me simply did not happen. And again, I don't like to call anyone a liar or a hoaxer. But so I really think that he simply misremembered what happened. I don't know exactly where he got it. He did say something along the lines of, if these different things had happened over the course of a long time, he wouldn't have thought it was, you know, unusual. But because in his memory all these things happened in the same evening, to him that was. You know, conclusive evidence that in fact there was something unusual going on. And so what I think happened is, I think he just compressed different unusual things, you know, maybe a light burst at a weird time, or what, you know, take your pick. I mean, any number of things that a person might attribute to an unusual presence, again, within the context of a theater. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where it came from. And there, of course, there were also some local ghost hunters
perpetuating the stories and
getting some
mileage out of them.
Yeah, well, it was...
Well, the news likes to do that too, so...
Right. Well, in fact, it was it was bizarre. I went and did some... There's a group called New Mexico Paranormal Investigations, and they're a group of, you know, very typical, well-meaning, somewhat less than skeptical and scientific investigators who had done investigations that I'm sure we're all familiar with and were probably virtually identical to what Karen saw at Waverly. Lots of orbs, lots of EVPs, you know, lots of this and that. And in their investigations, and I'm using the scare quotes because you can't see it on the microphone, but I'm using the scare quotes investigations. They had taken pictures of orbs. They had just this and that and the other. And one of the things they had on their website, I think it's since been taken down, thankfully, but they had a photograph of an orb at the top of the stairs. And it said, note, you know, in this photograph on their website, the orb at the top of the stairs where Bobby died. And of course, the implication being that the orb is Bobby's spirit because it is being seen and photographed at the place where Bobby died. Well, no. Actually, if the ghost investigators had done a little more research, they would have discovered that in the Albuquerque Journal and the coverage on August 2nd, 1951, they would see that, in fact, it states that Bobby did not even die at the theater. When Bobby actually died on his way to the hospital, and he was alive, he had a pulse when he left the theater. So not only did Bobby not die on the stairs where the ghost hunters found his alleged orb ghost, he didn't even die at the theater. It's certainly true that he was fatally injured at the theater. I mean, that's true. But the idea that, you know, Bobby died here and we can still sense his spirit simply isn't true. If that's true, then Bobby's haunting an ambulance somewhere, somewhere in a parking lot.
Exactly. Made up after the fact.
Yeah. And I see, and another quick element to this was, and again, this is something that we all encounter routinely, was that the vast majority of the stories about the chemo ghost were simply copied from one place to another. There was virtually no real investigation, virtually nobody making any effort to determine if any of this is true. As far as I could tell, I was the first person to actually contact one of the crew of the Christmas Carol and ask them. I mean, this isn't rocket science. It's like, All right, this everyone's saying this happened. You say this happened. Let me talk to the director. The director says this didn't happen. All right, well, we have a problem here. But unfortunately, all the ghost hunters they were so busy copying from each other, making stuff up, adding stuff to their websites. In fact, in the process of this, I actually, the head of one of the most prominent local ghost hunting groups, plagiarizing vast amounts of a chapter on the Chemo Ghost from an earlier book. It was just word for word.
Not plagiarism, it's ghost writing.
You need to put some rim shots in this. But it was amazing to me. And again, it just reinforced what I found over and over again, which is that, a lot of the people who claim to be ghost hunters and claim to be investigators, they do nothing of the sort. They just read something on it, they cut and paste it, and then they call that their investigation. So, hey, that was sort of interesting. Anyway, so just to wrap up, so basically that all came about. The guy that I caught plagiarizing the stuff on his website, at the time that I was doing my Chemo Ghost investigation, they had said, well, you know, we've done an investigation here and we think there may be evidence of ghosts. Oddly enough, after I published my work in Skeptical Inquirer, I happened to visit their website and suddenly there's a little note saying, we've now decided that the Chemo Theater is not haunted.
Assessment.
yeah. By the way, right? No reference to my work. No reference to who showed that. It's like, yeah, we're not sure, but we're thinking it's not haunted. We'll move on to the next case.
Very impressive.
Yeah, and actually, it was funny because when I was doing interviewing the folks from the New Mexico Paranormal Investigations Group, I met with two of them, actually a brother and sister, I believe, and I met with them in the early stages of the Chemo Ghost story. We sat down in a cafe in Albuquerque, and they started out by talking about talking rather disparagingly about some asshole skeptic who had researched the Santa Fe Courthouse ghost several years earlier. And about, we've done all these investigations. And then, you know, there's some guy around here. He thinks he's he did something on some video in Santa Fe Court. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And I gradually realized they were talking about me. And
did it bug you?
No. I was like, interesting. Tell me more. I said, oh, yeah, he just doesn't know what he's doing. He calls himself a scientist, blah, blah, blah. So they're just remarkable. And it was great. And I said, well, okay. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know, everybody makes mistakes. I said, I'm just curious. What exactly did you find so wrong with his work? I mean, was he wrong about something? Well, no, he was basically right, but we just don't like how you approach it. Like, oh, okay. Well, my bad. You know, whatever.
Did you reveal your identity?
I didn't at the time. I think the later on figured it out.
Nice.
That was a lot.
Yeah. Wow.
In a nutshell, that's the.
That's good. You've covered a lot of stuff. Like, and we talked about talking to witnesses and see if their stories match up, which in this case they don't. Corroborative evidence and finding primary sources. The main thing that you talked about, though, there that I thought was really interesting for listeners, people who go do ghost investigations and break out the EMF equipment and don't bother to do the historical side really are missing the point of, you know, trying to find out whether anything is going on at all.
Exactly.
And what is it you talked about here, the Hyman's categorical imperative, Ben? You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, basically, I mean, that's a dictum created by CSI fellow Ray Hyman, who's a psychologist at the University of Oregon, and just an amazing guy. He's done all sorts. He's a psychologist and a statistician, and he does a lot of stuff. But he came up with what's called Hyman's categorical imperative, which is sort of a fancy way of basically saying that before you try to explain something, you should make sure that there's something to explain before you start chasing your tail and trying to figure out, you know, how did this come about? The first question should be, did it come about? So invoking that, I could have begun my investigation of the Chemo case in many different ways. I could have asked to do an overnight vigil for whatever reason. I could have, tried to, I could have hired some actors to recreate A Christmas Carol and try to figure out how parts of the scenery could have flown. You know, I mean, I could, you know, you could do that, but instead of going to all that, first, you know, find out, did this really happen? And in this case, as you point out, is a very good example of no, it didn't happen. There's really nothing to explain.
And also, you know, if one of the things you can look at is whether or not any piece of evidence would falsify the whole claim. You know, for example, in your Rose Hall case, it would, to give like the nutshell version, ultimately that ghost is not even based on a real person.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give a quick rundown on the White Witch of Rose Hall. It's a case in Montego Bay, Jamaica, that I investigated a couple years back, and basically it's this giant mansion, this what's called a great house, that was used 150, 200 years ago, and it's allegedly haunted by a woman named Annie Palmer, the White Witch of Rose Hall, supposedly. And as you know, again, going back to Waverly, it's supposedly a place of horror and death and unspeakable cruelty and some always sadism. It always is, right? And it never happens when I'm there. apparently, there are all sorts of, you know, stories about Annie Palmer and this and that. And in fact, there was a book by H.B. DeLisser, Herbert DeLisser, titled The White Witch of Rose Hall, upon which it was sort of a bodice-ripping novel in some ways, set, I think, 1880s or something, a little later, that sort of told the fictional story of Annie Palmer and her haunting Rose Hall, but it was allegedly based on a real woman named Annie Palmer. All that is really exciting and interesting until you actually do some research and you realize that there was no Annie Palmer. So the people who go to Rose Hall and say that they're communicating with Annie Palmer's ghost and they're photographing her spirit, they're photographing a fictional character's ghost. I mean, there's nothing there. And I should add that the White Witch of Rose Hall is chapter 13 in my upcoming book, Scientific Paranormal Investigation, How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries, due out later this year.
Cool.
And I understand there's a couple other people who contributed to that.
Excellent. I look forward to reading it.
They're
really
cool.
Should. Didn't you guys contribute something?
I believe.
Why, yes.
Yes, I believe I did. Yes.
That is awesome. Well, why don't you just take a second to say what you contributed?
Oh, don't do that to us. I can't remember.
I'll give you a hint. Yours is on Waverly. This is a great tie-in, Karen.
So I think I contributed on didn't I do something about the basics of ghost photography?
Yes.
I believe I did. And that's, you know, in fact, a lot of my ghost photography information comes from my investigation into the ghosts of the Watertown ship.
Yes, tell us about that.
Well, I would like to tell you about that, but we're running really short on time.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to Monster Talk. That ends part one of our two-part discussion of historical paranormal investigations. We'll be back in a couple of weeks to talk about my investigation of the SS Watertown ghosts, the write-up of which is currently in the UK April edition of 40 and Times magazines, and which will be in the US May edition. We'll also get much deeper into how to do your own scientific paranormal investigation and talk about Ben's new book on the topic, which will be out soon. As a reminder, Monster Talk is produced with the wonderful help of Skeptic Magazine. Do you want to look smart but don't have the money for an iPad? Get Skeptic Magazine. It's cheaper, it's bendy, and you can use it during landing and takeoff. Want to read more from myself, Ben, or Karen? Go to monstertalk.org and you'll find links to all the places where we post. Thanks again for listening. Monster Talk theme music by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Intro music was Vampire Organ by Jeff Rosiana, both used by permission.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
So, does this microphone make me sound like Barry White?
It makes you sound white.
Oh! Zing!
Yes.